Welcome to Poetica's podcast series of Australian poetry. Mike Ladd with you. This program features the poetry of Geordie Alberston. Born in Melbourne in 1961, she studied flute at the Victorian College of the Arts before publishing her first collection of poetry, Nervous Arcs, in 1995. Already evident in her first book is her interest in historical documents and formal poetic structures such as the sonnet. Nervous Arcs was followed in 1996 by Botany Bay Document, a poetic history of the women of Botany Bay. This collection confirmed her fascination with documentary poetry, by which she meant poetry based on historical sources transformed by poetic imagination. The poems in this collection drew on shipping logs, newspaper excerpts, etchings, and letters. Her 1998 publication, The Hanging of Jean Lee, was also based on historical material about the last woman hanged in Australia. Both those collections were extended into works for radio and music theatre when Geordie collaborated with composer Andre Greenwell and producer Anna Messeriti. Dreaming Transportation, Voice Portraits of the First Women of White Settlement at Port Jackson, and The Hanging of Jean Lee were both staged at the Sydney Opera House Studio. Geordie Alberston's fourth book, The Fall, was published in 2003. The title poem is a 22-quatrain linked pantoum and was based on a famous 1940s photograph of a young woman who threw herself from the top of the Empire State Building and landed on a car roof. In 2007, John Leonard Press published Geordie's fifth book, Vertigo, a cantata, which is structured around a series of arias and recitatives. In this feature, Geordie Alberston talks about her writing with Anna Messeriti and reads a selection of her poems.
Loving at the ending of the world. Love, the horizon is changing, and the surface we stand on sinks slightly as the warm air rises. A fog of silence surrounds the world, the odd hole sucking the words right out of our mouths. Love, we hold confessions, statements, admissions, promises, whole paragraphs close to our hearts. Our minds wrap themselves around remaining phrases as we whisper our pledge not to forget. Love, the dialogue weeps as it breaks into parts, sentence by sentence, clause by clause, right down to the final letter. Entire volumes reduced to soft ash which blows away on our breath. Love, a poem loses its ink in the gutter, its lifeblood swirling in circles at our feet. The unread script washes slowly somewhere. Erased from memory, that poem will never be written again. Love, the horizon lies on a very strange angle, and millions have lost their tongues. The words I love you cost more than we have, but we spend them anyway, leaning, leaning into the sun's bright wind.
One, two, three.
My name is Geordie Alberston. I live in Melbourne and I'm a poet. I've published five books of poetry since 1995 and I'm currently working on a collection of sonnets. I have two adult children, Jesse and Caleb, two excellent dogs, Jack and evil Molly Flanders, and I've been writing since a very young age. I grew up in a household that was full of book lovers. From a young age, my father read to the children at night time books like Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie, Peter Pan, Dr. Dolittle, classics like that. There was also a particular grandmother on my mother's side who was very supportive of my writing. From kindergarten age, she would mark my poems and stories, give me a percentage, taking into account spelling mistakes, sentences and imagery and things like that. My parents in general were always supportive of my writing and of my reading. I remember one birthday I was given a toy printing press with lots of little rubber stamps and inks and different ways to lay out pages. And for a short time I wrote and constructed a newspaper for our street. Another time I was given a toy typewriter. And from about the age of 10 or 11 onwards, there was an enormous monster of a typewriter, a Remington, in the home. I remember at the age of 11, my father came back from England and he brought me back an anthology of contemporary poetry called People Within. And I still remember the first poem in the book was written by a girl called Zoe Brooks. She was only 13 years old, and the poem was called The Baby and the Mushroom. And the poem was about the birth of a baby, and at the same time it was about a nuclear mushroom cloud. That poem had a huge effect on me. I think it was the first time I consciously became aware of the fact that language could work on more than one level at once. This was the beginnings for me of thinking about metaphoricity.
Japonica.
One of the earliest poems I wrote, I don't have it anymore, was about a flowering bush we had in our garden where I grew up. It was a japonica.
Japonica.
And I remember looking japonica. At it and thinking about the word japonica, and walking around the streets japonica. Where I lived, which at that time were japonica. Half orchards, half houses, japonica. Half unmade roads, half sealed japonica. Roads. I just had the word going through my mind over and over again, japonica, and eventually wrote a short little piece playing on some of the sounds in that word.
Japonica.
Articolato. The word is a catechism of doubts, is structured in air, thinks in Helvetica font. It is empty as palm, full as closed fist. The word is hard to resist. It calls to me in bold, love, no love, rolls over the tundra like men lumbering out from the local mine, rolls over my tongue like a man. The word has escaped from my throat and all day I am chasing it down. Mile, mile, town, town, my word, that word is getting around. The word is out, but I don't know what its fate is. It climbs onto the roof of my mouth and jumps off, untranslated. Writing poetry, quite simply, had a lot to do with love of language and the sounds of language, the music that language is capable of. So I kept writing until I was about 15 years old, when I switched my focus to music. I'd already been playing piano for some years, but I began to play flute and guitar, and before long I was attending the College of the Arts Technical School, where I studied music for a time. It wasn't until I was about 28 that I returned to poetry. It was with a very strong feeling of returning home. The themes have changed, I guess, over the years, but I think the central impetus has remained fairly constant, exploring language, seeing how far it can be bent without breaking. Miscellany. Why is the man running, the one with the rankle? Why is the girl running, the one behind the man? Why am I running? Who has no hat? And why are the trees growing still? What is the boy doing with the periwinkle? Where is the dog walking? Where is the man with the dog walking too? Who is the dog's god? And where are the man's hands? Whichever way up go the hills. How many ids fit in a global buster, and what is the mean length of death? Who put the caterwaul in the kid's head? When do we all say smile? Where are the flowers gone? Oh, where are all the flowers? And where has the poor child hid? What was the word, you know, the one that was said? And does it say she is dead? I've never been what you might call a paper poet, someone who walks around with a notebook and a pen and makes notes here and there and then finally types them up. I've always worked directly onto computer, and prior to having a computer, onto electronic typewriter. Computer itself is a very important medium for me, and it's essential to the way I write. I'm quite sure of this. A few times I've been stuck without a computer and had to use paper and pen, and it's been an arduous and ultimately unsatisfactory experience. I find that when I'm writing with a pen onto the paper, that what I'm writing is absolutely concrete as it hits the page. I seem to lose the capacity to be able to imagine shifting the words around and reformatting things. And so it's pretty much what you see is what you get. Whereas on the computer, you're essentially looking at lights. The world that you're working with is conceptually spherical. You can go as far up or down or sideways as you want to. And so there's no fear of the edges of the page. I feel when I'm writing on computer that I'm almost looking into my own imagination, into my own psyche, and I can get lost in those lights. And I think there's a real liberty there, a real freedom, which the page doesn't afford me. Amoroso. The sea is a man murmuring it gently. You are never alone. You are never alone. He calls me under a lowering sky, invites me slyly to slip and slide beneath his confetti of ticker tape foam. Planets line up, the axis lunges, and Alaska falls right into China. I crashed into love one day like that and woke up a woman alone. The mountain is male. He roars like an iceberg on fire in the rain, shouting out to me over his pain, "Help me into your heart." I melted myself one night that way, but froze up quick smart again when I saw millions charging like moths love's flame float by dead the next morning. Look, even the poem is masculine now, mouthing out metaphors one by one, tongue in my ear, hand on my thigh, arms astretch in muscular lines. I am not inclined. I don't think I'd write the poetry that I do write if I didn't have such a strong background in music. And it's more than simple metrical structures and rhyme schemes and that kind of superficial music. There's a sense of orchestration that I think I've learned from music, which has an almost three-dimensional effect when it's successful in poetry. I do tend to think in musical terms rather than poetic terms. If I'm working with a triplicate kind of beat, I won't think of a dactyl or an anapest. I will tend to more think of triple meter or some term from music. And the same with the tempo of a poem. I will tend to think of Italian terms that are used at the top of a score to indicate how fast or slow a piece should be played. With my most recent book, Vertigo, a Cantata, instead of using any punctuation, I've employed bar lines and single bar lines throughout a piece, double bar lines with repeat signs if required, and a double bar line at the end. The book itself is divided into choruses, recitatives, and arias, the way a cantata is. Overall, I was attempting to emulate the secular cantatas, particularly those that Bach wrote.
1, 2, 3.
I'm going to read a poem called Whale Song. I wrote this poem when I was studying at university. I had two children and I was a single mother. I just finished reading Moby Dick by Herman Melville. I was very taken by the way Melville was able to intertwine history with a story. I've picked up on the character of Ahab in the poem Whale Song. I think I relate to Ahab as a solitary person. I've never really felt as though I properly belong in the world, and so Ahab was a figure with whom I could find resonances of my own self. In this poem, Ahab is searching for the whale. At times he's even riding the whale, and the whale in the poem represents life in general. The poem itself is written using a fairly formal voice. Again, I think I was trying to emulate Melville to an extent. Of course, his famous book begins with the stunning short sentence, "Call me Ishmael." Cast off like a choir boy on the celestial crescendo, I ride my Leviathan through testaments of deep. With my good leg astern and my ivory bone propped like a flag in the spiracle of this beast, I am Ahab still ploughing the vast body of then. Three quarters of me splutters in a fishbowl of water siege, yet I am captain of this voyage, revenge my first mate, ancient memory my faithful crew. It is a teary expanse that drenches my sight, eye of salt, lung of salt, my whole structure a tottery pillar of fear-crusty salt. Balanced on the bulk between heaven and dismay, I sway broken mast mad harpoon, stuck like a limpet on the hoary back of pain. But do your worst, cetacean shadow. I have flukes of my own, and when you sound, I can hold breath for a lifetime. Steeped in purpose, precious as spermaceti and morbid as amber grease, I am bound in blubber no loving barb can frustrate. Throw up what past treasure you can. Blast me with your blowhole. I will not jump ship until the sun itself drowns and the moon becomes fish, for I am one-legged Ahab with no shore for my soul, only this ocean of opalescence to mirror and mirror an old and landless heart. When the woman was a girl, she arose in one body and stood on symmetrical feet. The world was measured in big toes and hands. Her hips spanned a bridge from herself to herself. Her spine was a silent throne. When the woman was a girl, she drew crosses for plats, called her shadow by name, and reaching toward the stars, could touch. She lay among nasturtiums at noon. The flowers were yellow, Jaffa orange, red. She held the mustard pea under her tongue, stuck flat green leaves to her thighs with saliva, placed petals over her eyes. When the woman was a girl, she picked blackberries with her teeth. She watched time drift past in shades of blue and sang with the magpies at the sky. A bee stung her under the lemon tree, teetered and died when she suddenly cried. A fish brushed her shin with its fins. When the woman was a girl, she walked and ran and flew and swam with all the other creatures. Flat on her back in the nasturtium patch, she measured the world in big toes and hands, and it was very large. How are we going for time? Oh, is that all? No. Fine. Yeah,
we're probably halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
Or more.
Wake up, Jord. Wake up. My second book was entitled Botany Bay Document and subtitled A Poetic History of the Women of Botany Bay. I received a small grant to write Botany Bay Document and was able to visit Sydney and go to places like Botany Bay as well as the Mitchell Library and spend a lot of time looking at archival materials like maps and ship logbooks and diaries, letters, paintings, botanical sketches, anything I could get my hands on that would help bring to life these women. And I related on a personal level to much of what these women went through, whether the women were sent over on a convict transport for some petty crime or whether they had sailed as a free settler. They all faced hardships. They all were separated from their home and often from family and friends. There were very few amenities in Sydney at the time. Life was very difficult. I'm going to read Letter Home, Mary Talbot. Mary Talbot was an Irish woman convicted for stealing, and she was transported to Sydney very early on in 1791 without her children. The letter she wrote is the only letter of hers that survives, and she wrote it during the voyage out. She died soon after arriving in Sydney. We're not quite sure who her letter was written to, although it's assumed it was someone of a higher station than herself, possibly a former employer. Most honoured sir, since I was sentenced for lifting the linen, I have not seen my children except in my mind. Sir, I pine for their faces and soft little arms, and as they fall ever further behind, I beseech you to find them and, aided by God, restore them to their mother in time. I leapt into water from a Gravesend hulk, but was captured and sentenced to die. I then lay a long day in the Newgate jail, my death delayed by the child inside, till the court did decide transportation for life to the colony of Botany Bay. Sir, I did want to die. My shrieks echoed high as they replaced me to prison, my whole body crying at what lay ahead, protesting most strongly for the rope round my neck to stifle my sore sense of reason. But my sentence prevailed, and the Mary Ann sailed with my children's mother aboard. If you could afford further generous exertions on their behalf and on mine, pray apply for my pardon and have me return to the other side of the line. I thank God for your goodness and all of your effort to recall your most humble servant. And writing my name, I remain the same. Yours, Mary Talbot. I enjoyed writing Botany Bay Document so much that I wanted to focus on the story of one Australian woman alone. It was like a gift from above when I discovered Jean Lee. I was working in a bookshop at the time and a biography on Jean Lee had just been released. Jean Lee, of course, was the last woman hanged in Australia. She was one of only five women hanged in Australia and the only one to be hanged in the 20th century. There was not a lot of archival material available about Jean Lee's life. Unlike the Women of Botany Bay Document, there were no letters available, no journals or diaries. What we were left with were a school report, the court transcripts themselves from Jean Lee's trial, and a couple of reports that were written in prison. I've written diary extracts in The Hanging of Jean Lee in a similar fashion to the letters home in Botany Bay Document. This particular Dear Diary is 1951 and is spoken by Jean as she awaits her execution in her cell in Pentridge. God is pressing down on me with his almighty rod. Across my middle, kingdom, colony, he leans with all his pounds. God is pushing down on me. Split that spirit, flip that lid. He breaks out wildly from the Bible, cries aloud the way he did in olden other times. God is looking down on me with eyes as large as psalms. I talk to walls carved with his name, say it slowly all I can as he lifts up his silver arm and brings it home again. God is hurling angels down. I net one in my heart, pin her to my useless future, press her wings up idly to the light. Once Pentridge Prison had ceased to operate as a prison and was about to be developed as residential apartments, it was open to the public for a short period. And once while I was there, I had a friend of mine lock me in one of the cells in which Jean had been kept. The cell was very small, it was very cold, there was one tiny window up high. You really do feel that you are a long way away from the rest of the world. In Jean Lee's case, the light in her prison cell as she was awaiting execution was on 24 hours a day, so she had little idea of whether it was day or night. The poem Press On is, on one level, about depression. I was born with a neurological sleep disorder, and intense insomnia has always played a very large role in my life. So I think the fact that I was quite melancholy as a child and have suffered quite severe depression as an adult has a direct connection to this lack of sleep. Because, of course, when you're not sleeping and you're not dreaming, you don't wake up or get up feeling properly restored. In fact, my sleep doctor says that he thinks I became a poet because of my inability to dream. And so, in a sense, writing poems was a way for me to manually, if you like, sort out and catalogue things that had happened to me during the day, which in a normal sleeping person, the subconscious would take care of in dreams. Press on. Take short views of life, never further than dinner or tea. Press on through the delicate day of your ritual reality, the flags on the line, the forks in the drawer, the filial clichés calling from coat hangers on the back of the laundry door. The verdict is hung from every angle, every peg, the leg in the pantry, the salt in the pig. You endeavour to weigh all these things up correctly, to provide due process for produce in season, but feel cut off from the whole domestic realm. The fax is frantic, the telephone calls, the stove bell tolls for you alone, so fill your lungs with suburban air and press on. Yes, guide your hands to your father's piano and give them up gently to familiar chords. Raise your eyes to the long light ahead and press on. Though the heart has atrophied and the numberless moments you thought you possessed have gone, through the catacombs of conscience, the dreamless dawn and the unfinished night filled with silent guests, press on. Day one. Breakfast on the rooftop. Bitter coffee, little mezze. It is our niece, makes us all look up. Butterflies, butterflies dropping from the sky. 40,000 balloons firing happy morning missives through our sunny summer lives. Lunchtime in the field, gubebbia and wine, and like an instant floral wreath upon a godly flat, a naval flotilla floating out o'er the brine. Oh, watch how our waters part themselves for the armada, and see how the bright ships shine. Dinner at the cafe, but the tables are all gone, and instead of warm stifado, there are guns. Oh, where is all the laughter now? What is all this slaughter? Where is it we're going now, and who of us will be here when it's done? Midnight, and the M47 lurches and jerks, sits back on its haunches like a fat unicorn. The soldier in the middle is thinking like a fetus, dreaming dreams of drinking and of other men's wives. He stares at the darkness blink back. I was commissioned recently by a Sydney theatre group to write a series of poems looking at the 1974 invasion of Cyprus. The project appealed to me as a poet on a number of levels. One, because it deals with historical events that actually took place. Two, because there are a number of women's stories interwoven throughout these events. And perhaps more importantly than anything else, the poems intend to universalise war and trauma and partition, themes like this. Ghost Town is about the city of Famagusta in Cyprus, which is now cordoned off and has been so since 1974. It's thus an abandoned seaside resort where 40,000 people used to live. The way I look at Famagusta is as though it's a city in a time capsule, a city in stasis. Ghost Town. Ghost Town. The cars are in the car yards with no miles on the clock. The books are in the bookshops with the knowledge that they've got. The offices are hollow, the supermarkets flushed, and the houses have been emptied out of us. We visit when we can, and when we can't, we raise the glass. Next year in the ghost town, it's a kind of local must. Each day, each temple crumples. We watch it through the lens. Place the scene beneath our dreams to see it meet its end. Oh, yes, the morrow's sleeping room is now a nest of mites. And look, our favourite sitting spot has welcomed its demise. Oh, who cares for family? And who cares for home? There's blood enough to pave the way for all good gods to come. Oh, may the line partition and protect its sound divide. And peace and love continue to quieten these mounds. And may it all go on and on, shining brightly, wetly red, and may we sing forevermore next year in our town. The fall is not characterised by one story or set of stories like the two books preceding it, but is more characterised by the fact of form. It's a collection of chained verse poems, sestinas, pantoums, villanelles, ottava rima, also a few forms that I made up myself. In the poem Things to Do, Heart, I've tried to provide some kind of a detached view of the heart itself, as if it's some kind of jigsaw puzzle. It's written from the perspective of looking back at a trauma and the way one needs to be able to find a method or a methodology by which to put oneself back together again. Things to do, heart. A. Find heart and place hand upon it. B. Time to metronome beat. C. Empty above of all things earthly. D. Fill with compassion. E. Sleep. F. Remove heart while comatose. And G. Wrap in secondary skin. H. Attend to uncontrolled weeping. I. Inject with childhood whims. J. Apply usual pressures. K. Induce another few beats. L. Install restraints against sudden death flights of fancy and similar feats. M. Dream the dream of green things rising through cracks in the heart's veneer. N. Stir slightly. O. Open one valve. P. Put back to sleep again. Q. Attach block and tackle for possible messy escape. R. Invite intelligence in. S. Stitch up anything that gapes. T. Arrange worldly affairs in good order, alphabetically and from 1 to 10. U. Inform media of intentions. V. Alert next of kin. W. Insert telegraph pole for long distance out of town friends. X. Put heart back in. Y. Press all systems go. Z. Let your black ravens sing.
In Poetica's podcast series, we've been listening to the poetry of Geordie Orbiston. Geordie was interviewed by Anna Messeriti. The sound engineers were Andre Shabanoff and Judy Rapley, and the production was by Michael Bates. This project has been assisted by the Australian Government through the Australia Council for the Arts, its arts funding and advisory body.